I'm Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast. Welcome to Spark My Muse, everyone. Today, my guest is Detroit resident Jessica Aguilera-Christie. She is a woman of many talents. She is a designer. She teaches yoga and is well-versed in that. She also grounds it in Christian tradition. And she's doing a lot of interesting things in Detroit. The Slow Brood Theology Gathering. And she was part of Pints and Parables at the Kresge Mansion, where Peter Rollins came and did an event there. We talk about a wide range of things, and I hope you'll enjoy it. I also want to apologize for the audio. We were having some technical difficulties on this call, and there might be some trouble with the audio. I hope you can hear it all right. And let me know if you enjoyed it, if you have any suggestions for other guests, and I would really appreciate it if you would write a review about Spark My Muse on iTunes or share it with a friend. I sure would appreciate it very much. Thank you so much for listening. I'd love to find out what you're doing in Detroit and some of your background. I know you're a yoga teacher with a Christian center, and maybe you can tell me a little bit of what you're up to.
Well, I teach for a program called Soul Stretch Christian Yoga, which is operated by a woman named Jessica Bobian. The program's been around for about 11 years, and we primarily teach in churches around the city, like literally around Metro Detroit, not within the city. We tried to teach within the city, but didn't quite work out. So I've been a yoga teacher for about 8.5 years or so. I trained with Johnny Kest, who is the big yoga teacher in the area. He's also the national director for Lifetime Yoga in the Lifetime Studios. So he's very well known, especially in the Midwest. And back when I trained, back in 2008, I'd been practicing for about 5 years and experienced a lot of healing, a lot of inner transformation, and I knew there was something to this yoga thing. So I took yoga teacher training, and when it was over with, I just received so much wisdom that I needed to know how to integrate it more fully with my faith. So I did a deep dive into it, and the primary text that we used in our training was the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, which is it's a document that's about 5,000 years old. And nobody knows if it's, you know, students who gathered his wisdom and kind of dedicated it to him, or if he wrote it himself. It's just a body of work. Called the Yoga Sutras, and sutra, you know, meaning suture. So they're like stitches, like pieces of, and it's the same root that scripture comes from. They, you know, things that are knitted together to create a whole message. And within the Yoga Sutras, it's an eightfold path of transformation. And a lot of people look at, and what I learned was, there's a lot of people in the church that look at yoga as something that's Hindu, something that's, you know, something that doesn't go with Christianity, something that it's not. And what I found out is that if you take a look at the wisdom within the Yoga Sutras, it's actually an excellent path of formation for somebody of any faith. And it's a science. Of psychological and spiritual relationship, and within transformation to, you know, it uses a lot of philosophy and things like that. And also that there are many different kinds of yogas out there as well. Who are the guys in the airports? It's leaving my head right now. And the orange outfits. Hare Krishna. They're a form of mantra yoga. So they use sound, and they the same underlying philosophy of Patanjali is in their practices. And there's Kriya Yoga, which is that's a system of belief and action. There's Karma Yoga. There's all kinds of different forms of yoga out there. And the yoga that I observe is called Hatha Yoga. And so, and with what I found that there was a lot of relationship between the Bible and the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali. There's a lot of commonalities because the Bible is based in wisdom and the sutras are based in wisdom, but there's an eightfold path there. And what we've kind of lost within Christianity is that that bodily sense of holistic healing. We've kind of mistreated the body in a lot of ways, taking the word flesh literally. And whereas our body can be an excellent messenger of what is going on within our psyche, our soul, our spirit, and can be a tool for healing for us. And so I, you know, dove deep into this, and I came out with a whole retreat, actually, a whole retreat teaching on this eightfold path of formation. And I've taught it several times. There's a retreat center nearby called St. Paul of the Cross. And I've taught it there at least maybe two or three times. And I've taught it at my church as well. I haven't taught it in a couple of years just because some staff changes at St. Paul of the Cross. And I really needed to go back and revise and simplify because I'm one of those people that over researches things and probably does things a little bit more collegiate than is able to be digested easily by the average person. So I'm in the process of revising that work and actually creating a book out of it. Just moving through that, that process right now, in the midst of having a career and, you know, a marriage and a life and, you know, being active with my church and then doing things with Charlie kind of thing. So yeah, that's kind of who I am. And, you know, how I teach is I use a lot of that yoga philosophy of healing, of inner transformation alongside of the scriptures, because they just accompany each other so perfectly. And I teach a vinyasa class on Monday nights at Royal Oak First United Methodist Church. The class or the church? A vinyasa class. There are several levels of yoga that are being taught in the area right now. And I was taught at least five different forms of classes to teach. The first one is called Ashtanga. And it eightfold path actually means Ashtanga as well. It's a little confusing in this area because Ashtanga is also a class. And it's about 40 poses that you go through within an hour, and it's used to heal and tone the body. And then there's like a slow flow class where you just engage and it's slow flowing. There's a slow burn class, which is a little bit more long holding postures, a little bit more challenging. And then there's a vinyasa class, and vinyasa simply means linking breath and movement. And it's done at a faster pace. So it's like what you see hot yoga being out there. A lot of people call it hot yoga. So it's really meant to raise the inner temperature of the body and to help people to focus on sensations within the body and kind of transform themselves that way through breath. And then there's yin yoga, which is another form of yoga, and that's slowing things way, way down, which is also healing for the body. And when you engage in yin yoga, you do these long holding postures, and they're meant to smooth out the fascia in the body. And when you begin to smooth out the fascia, the muscle begins to return to its normal place within the body. So it's full of sensations, but at the same time, very healing. And what you begin to do is you use the breath and these long holding postures to begin to really create some deep healing within the body. It begins to kind of break down cellular structures of scar tissue. It helps to move toxins through the body. It helps to, like I said, kind of smooth things out so that things are working a little bit better.
Wow. Well, you know, what you're saying is so interesting that people are kind of wanting a balance, because just in the time, you know, the period of enlightenment is all this cerebral stuff going on, and our culture is so visually based, and it's visual, but also just kind of stuck in your head, and kind of people forgetting even what their body feels like until it's in a lot of pain. And this wake up call happens, like, oh, I haven't noticed, I haven't been in my body. I've been kind of just in my head. And then you have people going to hot yoga thinking, oh, I can feel my body again, you know, and you see people kind of being drawn into sensations and almost like, oh, this is a new thing. It's actually an incredibly old thing. And when you see scriptures, these festivals have smells and sounds and all kinds of things that engage the senses, which is kind of a return to how things have been, really.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it kind of comes down to this, to spirituality and, you know, to functions in the church and even within Buddhism and other things. There's a cataphatic side and there's an apophatic side. And since the Enlightenment, we've been very stuck in the cataphatic side, to the point where we've alienated those things where spirit and God can rise up from within on the apophatic side. And we've very much alienated it within the church. I know in that cataphatic thing that... And just to, I don't know if people know what this means.
Yeah, you can go ahead and define it. It's been defined, but it's been a long time since I did that, probably. So go right ahead.
It's you know, that it's having to address God with thoughts and words and images, and to you know, that visual sense of who God is, and that tactical sense of who God is, and being able to explain God and to put names on things within spirituality. That's kind of the cataphatic side. The apophatic side is the side of things where God just arises up from nothingness. We just see him come through in beauty, in nature, in science, and even from within our spiritual practices, just letting him rise up. And that is really hard to explain and to put names on. And because we're so addicted to naming and thinking and overthinking things, we've really let this side of things kind of be suppressed within us. And I know within my own yoga teaching, hatha means sun, moon. And it's balancing the warm energy with the cool energy, the yin energy with the yang energy. And I think that's very much like how we have to look at these two ways of practicing spirituality. We need to be balanced with our cataphatic and our apophatic sides, or else it creates all kinds of spiritual unrest within us. And we see that actively going on within our culture. We see what the evangelicals are doing right now, and it's not something that all Christians are proud of. And you can see it in other religions as well, even between Buddhists and Muslims in the Middle East and in Asia. And you know, it's that sense of, you know, masculine, feminine, light, dark, heat, cool, that balance within us that needs to be sought, because we can get really stuck in one way of doing things and alienate this precious resource that we have, that is just allowing God just to be who he is, allowing spirit to be what it is, and letting it rise up as it wants to be revealed to us. And that's what I really encourage my students to do, is to take the time to get still and to figure out what those sensations are and how spirit or God wants to speak to them through those things and heal.
Right. And with apophatic, which is, you know, a term a lot of people are not familiar with, but that can be a listening prayer where you might, you may or may not have to say anything to God. You can just sit and listen and wait on the Lord. And it can also come up in art, in music, in the arts, I should say. It can come up in a lot of different ways where,
yes,
there's sensations, there's no words. And so it's without words. And so that is something that a lot of people be like, oh, that's really strange. But actually, if you pay attention to your life and how you sense the world, it's kind of all over the place in and through your life already. You just haven't noticed that that's what we're talking about.
Right. And I think that's why yoga is so popular right now, because it's actively letting people do that. But the real spirituality comes is when you begin to connect that back to your Buddhism, back to your Christianity, back to your Judaism, back to your Islam. You know, that's when you really, it's not supposed to be a form of physical fitness. It's supposed to be holistic fitness for everybody, so that their spiritual side can have a sense of identity in whatever it's based in. And so that it'll really begin to work within them. A lot of people know me through the yoga community, but I'm the senior graphic designer for a software company's marketing organization right now, and I work out of downtown Detroit. So that's what I do for the bread and butter.
And is that your background? And have you been in Detroit have you been born and raised there?
Actually, I come from Flint. And I was born in Flint and raised there. And I made it down to Detroit because I needed to work. There's not that many design jobs in Flint. And so I was a contractor for about 12 years and then started working for this company about 2.5 years ago. So I've been designing things for a long time.
How were you raised in a spiritual or religious sense then?
I was raised Assemblies of God. I was baptized Catholic, but raised Assemblies of God because my grandmother on my father's side was in Azusa Street, like a revivalist type person. She was a Sunday school teacher for a long time. So I was raised in the Assemblies of God. So with that sense of mystery of who God is, but with a lot of emotionalism and not a lot of intellectualism, and there was, you know, although my church in Flint was started by a female pastor, there wasn't a lot of allowances for women to be in leadership unless they wanted to direct the choir or something like that. So I was raised along those lines. But when I was in junior high school, I went to a Lutheran school for 3 years. And so I went through Lutheran catechism, and then after high school, after college, I was part of a charismatic Catholic community for a little while. And then, which was very interesting because that's where the sense of mystery and the sense of liturgy kind of combined for me. And I really fell in love with liturgy at that time. And then later on, when I moved to Detroit, I started going to a Presbyterian church just because it was kind of close and somewhat familiar. And then I moved from where I was to downtown Detroit. And all my girlfriends were going to one of the big box churches in the suburbs, which I wasn't thrilled with. and I would find any excuse to not go to. So I was living right on Jefferson Avenue, and there was this beautiful Presbyterian church across the street at Jefferson and Burns called Jefferson Avenue Presbyterian. And so I thought, what the heck? I'll go there. I just started dating my husband at the time. And so we just fell in love with it. The pastor remembered our name the second time we were there. The teaching was solid. The community was open and integrated, and all the good things that a community should be, welcoming. So that was, you know, like, let's see, probably about 12 years ago. And we were married there in 2006. And I've been there ever since. And now I'm a deacon. And I'm up to all kinds of trouble. Like, we recently, I know, it's always like, this is what I've gotten you guys into. Recently, we hosted Peter Rollins' Pites and Parables at the Kresge Estate. And that was, Peter was delightful to work with. He was really, he's just delightful to work with. And he loves Detroit because it reminds him of his Belfast home. And he, you know, really enjoyed, had a blast being here and working with us. And I worked with Charlie Porter from the Fable podcast on that. He was one of the co-sponsors. And of course, the Kresge Estate, Patty Lynch of Lynch and Sons. He's a, you know, third generation mortician, just an excellent man to do anything with. He's just a pillar in this, like, kind of subculture community in Detroit. That was excellent. And I'm also, you know, doing other things with the church, like something called Slow Brood Theology. We used the visit from Peter to launch something new, program. We already have something called Bible and Brew at our church, in which one of our associate pastors, he gathers in the basement of, you know, a nice basement of one of the restaurants in Grosse Pointe and has a little Bible study with people. So we thought my husband and I thought we'd grow that, and we could turn it, you know, let Bible and Brew have a little child, have offspring for our younger people. And we decided to base that, after talking to Charlie and finding out the importance of story to people, and the importance of story is very important to me as well, I decided we should do something related to story with Slow Brood Theology. And basically what Slow Brood Theology is it's broken into two kind of parts. The first part is called the slow press. And the slow press is where we have a guest that gives a moth style, you know, 10, 15, 20 minute story about a situation in their life in which their faith was transformed from something that they thought it was to something that it no longer looks like, whatever that may be. And then they also give my husband and I a scripture, and we kind of, or a passage, and we kind of break it down for a few minutes. For like 5 minutes, we'll talk about the scripture, where people were at the time, how things were being handled, what was going on. And then we may have a poet read a poem or recite a poem, or we might have a singer-songwriter do some sort of song that's related to what's going on. We take a, you know, 10 to 15 minute break, let people refresh themselves and refresh their drinks, because it's kind of a BYO thing. And then we all come back and we have some honest conversations about faith and doubt and transformation. And what I'm really working to do is create a sense of community within those people. And it's done as an outreach of the church, and, you know, not, I don't want to force people to come to church, but, you know, our church is so welcoming of everybody. It really is. We have gay elders and deacons. We have, you know, a lot of African Americans. We have Filipinos. We have one Latina. That's me at church, you know. And it's just a very welcoming community. And we just want to wrap our arms around these people and let them know there's a home for you. You don't have to look, do, say, react to anything the way anybody else does. You can let the community play come your way, or you can pass it along. We just want to wrap our arms around you and welcome you to a place where you can find your spiritual home. So that's what we're doing at Jefferson Avenue Presbyterian with, you know, the help of Charlie Porter from the Fable podcast, because his podcast is so locally based that we really, you know, wanted to partner with him and a lot of the local things that he's doing. And we're so happy to have that connection with him in doing that.
I guess for people who are outside the Detroit metro area, maybe you can a little bit give a sense of what's happened to Detroit. It's hard for people who aren't from there, especially, I mean, we sort of know the broad sketches about Detroit, but could you a little bit paint a picture of Detroit and where it is now and what's been happening there?
Oh my gosh. So I've been living in the Detroit area since 2003. And when I came to Detroit, originally, it was, golly, it was, there was a lot of turmoil. There was always drama. There were abandoned buildings. There were fires all the time. It was just not a place where people wanted to go. It was not a destination. But, you know, we had the mayoral scandal of that time. And after we got over it, just, you know, the series of businessmen that have been mayors since then have really built some foundations to really turn the city around. And in terms of people wanting to take interest, and, you know, Dan Gilbert has bought a lot of property in the Detroit area and really made a big difference, hired a lot of young people, brought a lot of young people down, exactly what has been needed. You know, the culture is booming. A lot of people from LA and New York are moving here because it's cheap to live here and you can fulfill your dreams here. And it's incredible. But also, we still have a lot of the same problems. There's still a lot of poverty in areas. There's still a lot of crime. There's still a lot of stuff that people are still struggling. There's, you know, we have a big, even though we have the largest open air food market in North America, we still have a big food distribution problem within the city. So there's still a lot of poverty, a lot of work we have to do here in the city, despite how it's recovering and how it's moving forward. The company I work for is based out of Boston, but it has its roots in Detroit, which is a good thing. It's a good thing. There are a lot of companies that are like that are outside of the Dan Gilbert umbrella that are doing that. But at the same time, there's still a lot of people who don't have jobs and things like that. But Detroit is something that shouldn't be feared, to be honest with you. And it's not something that people should, you know, from the suburbs should dump on, because we can all benefit from what's going on here in the city. And I know one of the biggest contrasts between like 13 years ago and now is that I see people in the suburbs wearing shirts that say, you know, Detroit versus everybody. You know, and it's like, huh, when was the last time you've been to Detroit? You know, and they're starting to get it a little bit, but there's still a lot of work to do. And our church, Jefferson Avenue Presbyterian, has been in Detroit. It was built in the late 1920s. So it's about to celebrate its 90th birthday. I think next May or the following May is our 90th birthday. So one of our mottos in the church is serving Christ in the midst of Detroit. And we have so many programs. We have food programs. We have a tutoring program. We have our, you know, external teaching programs like Bible and Brew and Slow Brewed Christianity or Slow Brewed Theology, that are outreaches out of the church just to help that help us grow. But we're still incredibly based in Scottish tradition as well. On November 20th, we have every year the Sunday before Thanksgiving, we have a huge Kirkin of the Tartan. And that basically means all of the Scottish people come to our church that day and proudly show their tartans during church. And we celebrate, you know, Bonnie Prince Charlie and have a big liturgy based on our Scottish identity. The St. Andrew's Society Pipe and Drum Band comes. And I tell you what, Lisa, when they play Amazing Grace, you feel it in your DNA. You feel your DNA vibrate. It is incredible. And it's just all of the pomp and circumstance of being Scottish, and it's wonderful. And we have a big Cayley afterwards with the ladies in the church. You know how church ladies can cook. And we have probably any kind of shortbread you would ever want to eat, like at least 4 tables full. And then tea, and we have a crafters fair, and then we have Scottish dancers, and the pipe and drum band plays, and it's our high holy day within our church. It's a lot of fun. So,
well, that's definitely very traditional for the Presbyterian traditional stuff. I don't think I've ever seen any Presbyterian church whip it all out there like that.
Oh yeah, we've been doing that for 90 years.
wow. Yeah, well Charlie gave me the kind of broad strokes of what you're doing, and Jessica's up to big things in Detroit, and because I was asking him, how did Pints and Parables go? Do you want to come on Spark My Muse and talk about, you know, some of the nuggets and what you got out of it? And he was like, you know, the person you really need to talk to is Jessica, because, you know, she really, you know, spearheaded this, and she's the person you have to talk to. And so I should just direct my questions right at you. What were some of the best parts that you felt Peter brought to your event, and some of the nuggets you would take away from what he taught you?
Well, I've been listening to Peter for a long time, for a couple of years now. And, you know, anything that he would say in person, you could probably hear it already on online. But when Peter shows up, he brings this sense of community, this sense of coming together, of basically letting your spiritual freak flag fly. You know, I know it was just really great to sit back in that room and to see all those people just listening and to what he had to say, and just really absorbing it and being refreshed by it. He has such a unique perspective, and I think it comes from his upbringing in Belfast, with being part of the Troubles and seeing things from both sides. And just really internalizing that for a long time. And with all of the wisdom that he's, you know, gained from that. And then plus his academics around that surround philosophy. It's no wonder he went into philosophy. He has such a rich, you know, the landscape of his mind is just really rich. And he's able to pull out just what the crowd needs to say when they need to hear it. Thursday night Pints and Parables was just beautiful. So many people from so many places made so many connections that night. I know I met the pastor at the church where I teach yoga that night and reconnected with a bunch of people. And a lot of people came up to me afterwards and said, thank you for doing this. Thank you for bringing this together. I really needed this. So to me, it was mostly what he, how he brought in a sense of community, and how he, just the way he treats people with such intellectual and spiritual respect by what he delivers. I think people are really honored by that.
Yeah, he has mentioned that if he ever moves from LA, Detroit would be the place he'd want to go in the United States. And he likes the city, you know, the city life, and he's completely comfortable in like unfinished places. And it's it's kind of an interesting thing that he embraces the unfinished, the broken spots, and wants everybody, Americans especially, to be okay with sorrow and not be fearful of it, not try to cover it over with some sort of, you know, anesthetize it or something. And I deeply appreciate that about him. And I think people who've suffered, who can hold that intention, kind of understand that wisdom, but it's really hard to, it's a really tough sell. If people aren't used to that, because it's much easier to distract yourself or to drown it out with some sort of something.
Yeah. I had one person in particular tell me, can't figure out if he's, you know, really sincere or starting his own, if he's like some sort of guru that's trying to get followers. And, you know, I had to break it down for him that the fact that you're asking yourself that, he'd be really proud of you for asking that, because, you know, he wants you to break things down. He really wants you to think about things. And just a lot of his work on suffering, talking about, you know, his research with Jacques Lacan in terms of letting those, and I even use this within my yoga teaching, because it aligns with yoga so perfectly, to let the suffering in your life, let those symptoms, as Jacques Lacan put it, be symptômes, or holy men in French, that reveal to you your deepest truth. That type of teaching really hits home for me, and I think with a lot of other people, it really hits home in that we want to listen to our suffering. We want to listen to how God is speaking through it, instead of covering it over with praise and worship songs and covering it over with platitudes. There, we just are faced with so many platitudes within the church that we really want to get through healing and wholeness, make it through this thing in one piece. And he really gives people a sense of community around that as well. So,
and to add something to what that man was talking to you about, is he does approach things as a psychoanalyst would. When he had the ICON community, that was essentially a kind of church, and they ended it on purpose because he was not supposed to be the leader. Like, in the same way a psychoanalyst is supposed to reflect back your psychoses to you, or your neuroses to you, and then you realize that you can be healed. You know, the patient becomes dependent on the psychoanalyst, and then they realize that they have what it takes to be healed. And then that person, that psychoanalyst, becomes obsolete. He's trying to do the very same thing. So he actually addressed this once. I think that this is available on, I know it's available on a few of his free Facebook live things that he does, that he has a lot of free things, and people can see this on his Facebook live things. But that person, whoever, definitely have him look that up, because it's really interesting how he says it, because there's this danger when leaders come into prominence and people start following them like, you know, sheeple, and they, you know, start to adore this leader, and, oh, he's so wise, he's so smart. And then they do the same thing. They become more sick instead of more well. And this, especially in the United States, we have these messianic problems where we,
yeah,
you know, let's have a new Messiah so that we don't actually have to be well. We can just trust so-and-so to heal our problems. And not realizing that we have some internal work we have to deal with ourselves that might be ugly or scary or dark. And it's if ourselves are reflected back to us, that might, we might stand a chance to do that. But mm-hmm. if the leader says, no, I'll handle it. Don't you worry your pretty little head. I'm going to handle all your problems for you. You know, there's no chance that you can get well.
Right. Absolutely.
So, yeah, I think what he does, so he doesn't really, I just took the course that that was like the Friendly Fire course. Mm-hmm. And so he leaves things that seems to me like purposefully sort of hanging in different mm-hmm. spots at the end. And you're kind of like, oh, Peter, give us more. And it's like, but the whole thing is that I'm not going to solve every question. I'm not going to answer every question. Right. I'm not going to solve every problem because that's not my role. And mm-hmm. I actually really appreciate that because this guru status of someone like a philosopher can happen really quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. That's so, true.
Yeah. Especially someone who's like, he is wise and he does have a lot of things that he could say, here are all the answers for you. And,
you know, at the same time, he puts his pants on like everybody else, you know, and I got to hang out with him a little bit and he's just a normal dude, you know, he's a normal dude who watches Netflix and reads books and he listens to music, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, it's good for people that's what's so fun about, seeing someone in person like that and actually rubbing shoulders in just an environment where you can have a drink with somebody and talk. Mm-hmm. And it's not like a stadium, you know, it is like a pub atmosphere, not mm-hmm. like a, you know, a stadium with somebody where they have the lights on them like that. And it's more a normal atmosphere.
And a really cool thing that Patty Lynch did, when we ended it, amongst other wonderful things, he invited everybody to stay for an hour and to finish all of the libations that were there. And it was really gracious of him. And there were a lot of great conversations going on. You could just sense it in the air that people were just really feeling, getting what they needed, you know. And I know we sat down, my husband is a spiritual director, and we sat down with some friends and really had some deep conversations. And all of my yoga teacher buddies from the program that I teach with were there and they got to see each other. And it was just very rich. It was such a rich evening for everyone. You know, and that, you know, for Peter just to help to make that happen, I think was very worthwhile as well. Well, we're going to start off with this slow brood theology, see how, probably do one a month. I know Patty Lynch has already kind of leaned in and asked my husband, okay, so who are we bringing in next? I think he is really interested in continuing things in the Pints and Parables pattern at the Kresge Estate. So we'll see how that goes. I know, you know, Charlie and I might have a few people in mind. We need to sit down with Patty about that. But, you know, we're really continuing on this vein of slow brood theology for now, just to continue to create the community, continue to have those discussions, so that people can have those experiences where they can feel home and they can feel they're on a track of wholeness, whether it be with certain aspects of faith or without them. So that's what we're doing. I know on November 13th, we're having Charlie Porter from 5 to 7 p.m. at the Kresge Estate. It's kind of I'll have a few bottles there, but it's kind of a bring your own thing. Bring one for you and one to share if you want to. And then on December 11th, we're having Patty Lynch himself. he's a third generation mortician, and he's a very interesting young man. He calls the Kresge Estate, he says it's like a funeral home with no dead bodies. So So it's a place where people come. They kind of have their laments. They sit around, talk, deal with them, and then they move on, kind of thing. So we're excited to have him and have him share a story of faith. And then by that time, I think we'll have some more guests planned for, you know, January, February, March. And the artist, songwriter, producer, Ashley Peacock might show up for either one of those and do a couple of songs. So we're trying to keep it open right now, and just let it be what it is. You know, I've kind of put together this very loose format, so that people could just come listen and be, so that's what we're doing to kind of continue this vein.
That reminds me, there's a tie-in. Have you heard of death salons? Have you heard of this?
No.
This trend? It's something to look up and look into a little bit, because the mortician, there's a tie-in here that seems really obvious to me, but it's a fascinating trend. It's especially, they're all over the country, really all over the world, and people come together to talk about death, because we are so removed from the actual physical process of it, because it's handled away from us, and that when people actually talk about, like, physically what happens to you, you'll just have to look it up. But
okay,
it's really, really, really fascinating, and this is among usually younger generations of people, and they might have an artistic, there might be poetry, there might be a scientist kind of coming in. And what people are doing is they want to know more about it, because it's been, people in cultures have usually buried their own dead up until really, really recently. And now it's something people fear just because it's unknown. Instead of thinking about it as, you know, this is when your loved one dies, there's a grieving process of where you might care for the body, wash the body, and have a whole, you know, ritualized thing that helps you mourn a death and say goodbye. But now everything's handled, and you sometimes nothing happens.
Yeah.
You know, it's just this strange, like, did they go on vacation? You know, and it's a fascinating thing that has a really, especially for Christians, has an excellent kind of component there that can deal with sorrow in a different way, or in even for people who are in a place of doubt or you know, fear or sorrow or anything like that. So you could just look up, I think it's just deathsalons.org. This is an aside. I'll probably have to cut this all out. But
okay.
Being that you have a mortician there who really confronts this all the time, it would be a fascinating perspective for that to be covered at some point, maybe. But I had someone on my podcast who took what's called a death class, and each time they went to a different place. They went to, they went to a mortician, they went to a morgue, they did all these different things to kind of understand the process of death. And it was really, for everybody involved, it was difficult, but then at the end, everyone in the class was so glad they did it and really treasured life much more.
Yeah.
So it has a big, it's one of those things, like, we're all, or I should say these people who participated had all the different reasons for participating in the class. But in the end, you know, this is what it is to be mortal, and it's coming, and it's coming for our family members. Well, I lost my dad when I was 20. And so these are just things that I think of. And I think about, you know, of course, my own mortality more than maybe the average person. But I was thinking, wow, you have like what you said about the funeral home without the dead bodies, you have the mortician, like, this is the perfect death salon location. But and with your group coming, who are probably fully prepared to deal with deeper and weightier topics, that might be well received, who knows?
Yeah. I'll have to look into that. I know, being Mexican in descent, we have a different perspective on death as well. In that, you know, here it is, we're a couple of days from Dia de los Muertos. And even in the DIA, we took Peter through the DIA, and he walked through the altars and took some pictures of things that he just really thought were cool. We celebrate the dead. We have that one day a year where we get filled up with those memories and we celebrate them, the people, and we live in that space where they're, if not, you know, theologically, spiritually amongst us, their energy is with us. Their love is with us for that period of time. And we sing songs and light candles and things like that. I've only celebrated from an armchair perspective because all my Mexican family is in Mexico. But I have a little tiny ofrenda with a picture of my grandfather and my grandmother and my uncle, and I have it close to a picture of my dad, and just kind of reflect on them and live with their love for a couple of days, and that's healthy, that's healing, and to know that their life goes on in those moments.
Right. They are their eternal life is in our memory, as much as it is anywhere else. I think there's actually something very powerful and life-giving about that they get a special day. I totally support that. I think, is that also connected with that the monarch butterfly migration as well? Is that connected with that? Because I heard that there was, that if I heard this correctly now, that the monarchs migrate from like Maine to a place in Mexico, and that that's kind of the time of year when they all get there, and that they're, you know, these transformed creatures in their own right, and that there they come on this, basically around this time of year as well, every single year. Mm-hmm. And that, that plays a part in the whole story as well. But that it's a really, it's a beautiful thing. Like, we think that we, not that everybody thinks this, but they don't have to go away because they're gone. You know, they don't have to, I think Peter Rollins says a ghost is the presence of an absence, how he says, and that these ghosts can be poltergeists if they're unholy ghosts, but then when we find healing there, these presences, what any kind of thing, whether it's some kind of old wound or even just someone we miss, can become holy ghosts to us. Mm-hmm. And there's something, he's not talking in literal terms or anything, but then, you know, it redeems those memories. It redeems those hurts too, to think that, there's nothing shameful or wrong about remembering people and even still grieving them years later, because it shows that they meant something to us.
Right.
And, I think we can have a real twisted view of grief and mourning when we think, well, that's, you know, we don't want to think about that anymore. That hurts, and that's in the past, and let's get on with life. But why not revisit our ancestors, our past, our elders, and remember their lives and their memories? I think there's something very, very healing and very calming and soothing about that to me.
Absolutely.
And knowing that someone will do that for us one day.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Yeah, I was, my daughter's taking Spanish class now, and she said that they watched the Book of Life, and she's like, oh, it was really good. And now I'm like, all right, let's get that. I want to see that soon, because I don't know too much about it. It's not in my, I don't know what Puerto Ricans do about that, but I'm not too connected with that one, but I know, that's something that I want to look into and see more about it. But yeah. Do you have children of your own?
Not yet. We're working on it.
I was thinking that that's kind of an interesting thing to include in formation of spiritual formation for children too, because it's easy to, when kids are little, to shelter them from. I think I was sheltered from a lot of, like, I wasn't taken to any funerals or anything like that. Now, I think how we teach younger people, whether children or just younger people, how we teach them how to approach death will form them and teach them how to respond and react to suffering of all kinds, not just death. But Well, thank you so much. This has been such a delight and kind of like a total surprise, because I figured we'd be talking about Detroit the whole time, which is also very cool. But like, this is like I found like a treasure chest here, basically, and really just very appreciative to you.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. Anytime.
Don't forget to check out sparkmymuse.com, where there's show notes to this episode and every episode, with related links and photos and all kinds of extra goodies. But I also want to ask a special favor too. Please donate $5 or $10 to the show. It's listener supported. It makes a very big difference when you help out. Another thing that helps out is a rating or review on iTunes and spreading the word with friends and family. Please help the show survive, and thank you so much for listening.